Hi, welcome back to Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. It's February 5th, 2017. I'm Tamsin Granger.
And I'm Dan Abuhoff.
And here we go. We have a lot to talk about today. Kind of a busy weekend. We were out to Long Island yesterday, and on the way back, we stopped in New York City to go to that play. David Ives.
After I took you to
Trans.
Dinner. After I took you to dinner.
Very nice dinner.
Right.
Lebanese restaurant.
Exactly.
Shawarma.
Whatever you want.
Hummus.
That's right.
Falafel.
Turkish coffee.
Very good stuff.
Yes.
Very nice people. Excellent service. Okay.
And then we saw The Liar at the Classic Stage Company, a theater downtown, which we've been to a few times before. And had some fascinating stuff, and had some fascinating stuff last night.
First of all, it's a teeny-weeny theater. So we bought tickets for $60. We're in the fourth row.
And the fourth row is the last row.
And that's the last row.
Right.
Yeah. So it was a, as we said before, a French farce, sort of a modern adaptation by David Ives. He calls it what? A
translation. Yeah, I don't want to say that. It's going to get us in trouble. I think it's a translaptation. It's a combination of a translation and an adaptation. So maybe it's translaptation. You don't want to say it, honestly, in the idea.
But he did more than just translate it.
That's right.
He made some subtle changes in some of the settings. He added a character. He dropped a character. Right.
And just to set the stage here for David Ives, he had done other noteworthy efforts in the past, including Venus and Fur. Venus and Fur was at the Classic Stage.
We already said that. Go on. How did you feel about the play?
The play last night was excellent.
The actors were hilarious.
Well, we don't have to say what it's about. It's kind of a slight play. It was written in the 1600s. It's written by Corneau. Is that the name?
No, Pierre Corneille.
Corneille. I was very close. Corneille is what I meant to say. Corneille. It's a fairly slight comedy. Following the translaptation, whatever that is, it's still a fairly light comedy, but it's funny and entirely contemporary, notwithstanding that it's written in verse, iambic pentameter.
And the verse was fun. The verse was not annoying. Didn't you think so? You weren't put off by the verse.
Oh, no. The verse was great.
And we didn't know any of the actors, but they were terrific, especially the manservant who can't help himself but tell the truth. It was telling the truth and making up fibs and
the main character is the liar.
So there's mistaken identity. Right. There's love. There's relationships between fathers and sons and best friends and twins.
Mostly there's confusion over identities. People not knowing who they are, long lost twins, all that kind of stuff. Which, generally speaking, I find terribly unattractive. But having said that. Sometimes it works, and it worked last night.
Yeah, it was great. So that was a lot of fun. And then
we recommend it.
Yeah, if you get a chance to go into New York and see it, as we said, the tickets are quite affordable, and it's a great way to see a play with great cast, great little theater. So, I also wanted to mention, while we don't have a lot to talk about theater-wise, but I did want to mention there is a... some nice pictures of the renovation of the Hudson Theater in New York City. One of the things that's interesting about that is that's where Sunday in the Park with George is.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, with the new, with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Mm-hmm.
So, and one of the great things about it is, some of these old theaters really have such fantastic details, the coffered ceilings, all kinds of gilded brass, falderal, etc. Really fun decor. But one of the things they've done in this renovation is made the seats 23 inches wide.
You're going to help me here. Is that wide or narrow?
That's wide. That's wide.
Okay, good.
That's wide.
What
is one of the big problems with the Broadway theaters is you can be so uncomfortable.
Well, nothing persuades you as quickly as a Broadway theater that people used to be smaller than they are now.
Well, either the seats are too small or the aisles are so narrow that you have nowhere to put your legs, your knees. I mean, I do have the shortest legs in the universe. And if I don't have room, I don't even know how you can be comfortable in some of these theaters. So that's kind of neat. So that's kind of good. Yeah. And by the way, we should say Sunday in the Park with George, Stephen Sondheim, is kind of slightly based on La Grande Jatte by George Seurat, famous painting you may know. You may know.
Yeah, I know. I was just going to say, I think it's slightly based. They actually have, they all set up in a mural sort of representing it. It's more than slightly based.
What do you call that? Well, there's a word for that.
Tableau.
Tableau?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so not my favorite musical necessarily. I mean, I do like Sondheim.
Yeah.
But anyway, it got incredible reviews.
It did. It did. So, and we may break down and buy
tickets. So now you know.
We'll let you know if we buy
tickets. A good place to see
yeah.
a Sondheim play. But moving right along here, one of the things I noticed in the New York Times today, I guess in the Metropolitan section, was a little story about, it was jumping off from all the demonstrations that have been occurring the last couple of weeks in and around New York and the United States, and it actually conjured up a food riot that started in Brooklyn in February in 1917, near some, apparently a woman was out at some, market where the push carts are, and was so disgusted and frustrated, didn't have enough money to pay for the food for her children. She pushed the push cart over, and all kinds of women joined in, and there was kind of a riot that they say was over 1,000 people and lasted for 2 hours or something like that. And did you ever hear of this?
No, it's news to me. It's 1917.
Yeah, and then I think the next day or so, 400 women actually stormed City Hall in Manhattan, led by someone named Sweet Marie Gantz, who apparently was not sweet at all. It was kind of an ironic nickname. And she was kind of a rouser, and had actually been to jail for storming into Standard Oil headquarters with a gun. She was going to shoot John D. Rockefeller.
That'll do it. That'll get you to jail.
Because she felt he was abusing striking miners in Colorado.
That might have been happening. That could actually within the realm of possibility.
So anyway, these kind of demonstrations go way back, and sometimes they're fairly effective. The city actually made a point of locating, buying thousands of pounds of more affordable produce, which they turned over to wholesalers and were able to get to the people.
That's a fundamental impetus. I mean, if you can't feed your children, you have riots. You have demonstrations. Apparently, that's what they had in 1917 in the United States, although it was news to me.
And just on a side note, the legend is that once Sweet Marie got married, she actually settled down and was quite sweet.
Really?
Yeah.
I have no comment on that.
Neither do I.
I'm not going to say anything about that. That's counterintuitive. Here's something else that's somewhat related to the demonstrations, to the Women's March of a week or two ago, and there's an article in the Times about Harry Belafonte, who was a cultural icon, 1960s or thereabouts, late 50s, early 60s, but he's been in the news since then. What I didn't realize is that...
Wait a minute, who's Harry Belafonte?
I'm getting to it. Yeah. Well, hold on. But I didn't realize that Belafonte was the co-chairman of the Women's March, along with Gloria Steinem, although his health kept him from being at the event. Eric Belafonte was a calypso singer.
So give me some of his
The banana
songs.
Song. That's the only thing. Deo. I'm not saying.
Deo.
There you go. That sounds exactly like Harry Belafonte. That was it.
Uncanny.
It is uncanny. It's almost as if he was with us now, except that Harry is 90 years old. So he doesn't have quite the buoyancy Tamsin has when he does the Deo song. In any event, an article about Belafonte, who was a huge cultural figure. It's hard for me to describe how big a figure he was to those who weren't around in the early 1960s. And he became a substantial political figure. And he befriended and became allies with people like Martin Luther King and others who supported the civil rights movement, has always been active. And it's a poignant article because it obviously he's not the figure he once was. At 90 years old, he's looking back on his life and trying to determine how much he accomplished, how much the movement accomplished. And a very poignant quote in the Times, which says, this is Belafonte, "I often look at the journey and I don't get it. I really don't. I've lasted longer than I understand why. I often feel there must have been something that I should have done that I didn't do, but I can't identify what it is that I didn't do." That's the first difficulty. And the second is, what makes you think you're it? Interesting. Interesting because Belafonte is kind of reflecting and wondering where we are and just, you know, how fleeting fame and being so-called, you know, critical figures in history really is. I mean, he's a man who's, I won't call him forgotten, but he's not the figure he once was. And you can see he's looking back with mixed emotions.
Well, I'm looking at the article right now, and there's a little headline there. It says, "It's my last chance to say what I feel I need to say." So that's a little poignant, too. Like, you know, trying to continue to participate, continue to have some relevance and be part of what's going on and get it all out.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to our next story. Our next story has to do with mothers. Tams was talking about mothers demonstrating in 1917, and in particular one sort of controversial figure. The Times has an article about the mother of Neil Gorsuch in today's paper. Neil Gorsuch, of course, being the nominee for the Supreme Court. His mother was a political figure. His mother, whose name was Anne, was the first women's head of the Department of Environmental
Protection.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Firstly, the EPA. And she's a
pretty... Under Reagan, right?
You said it was under Reagan, yes. She was a big follower of Reagan, big supporter of Reagan. She was in the House of Representatives, was elected before she was appointed to head the EPA. When she was in the House, and even her early political career was such that she was fervently anti-abortion, which I'm sure is something that folks are going to pick up and write about in connection with their consideration of how Gorsuch will reflect on Roe versus Wade. There's a great quote attributed to his mother, who was, like Gorsuch, grew up in the West and was transplanted east to be a legislator. She said that Washington, D.C. was, quote, "too small to be a state, but too large to be an asylum for the mentally deranged."
What does that mean?
I don't know. It's a good quote. But it's she had a way with words, and so does Neil Gorsuch. That what the Times follows with in their article, and it's a good article, they have all sorts of quotes from the young Neil Gorsuch when he was in school. He went to Georgetown Prep, first of all.
Shout out to Georgetown Prep. That was right down the road from where I grew up. And my brother Bryce went there.
Did very
well there.
As did,
got a great education. Georgetown is a Jesuit boys' school.
And Brian Cashman went there, for those who don't know Tamsin's brother, who's the general manager of the New York Yankees. So there are some luminaries. In any event, he went to Georgetown Prep, and then went to Columbia, and you can see various things that he said when he was in school. But what's perhaps of more immediate interest is what he's had to say as a judge. And Gorsuch has the reputation of being a clear thinker and a spectacular legal writer. People talk about the quality and how engaging his opinions are. And I'm just going to read to you a couple three examples, and you'll see exactly what I mean. Okay, here's the way one opinion begins. Quote, "Weeks before, 11-year-old, 4'11", 96-pound Brandon Blackman arrived at the Juvenile Detention Center in Sedgwick, Kansas. Officials there made a new purchase, the Prostraint Restraining Chair, Violent Prisoner Chair Model RC-1200. The chair bore wrist, waist, chest, and ankle restraints all. In the months that followed, the staff made liberal use of their new acquisition on the center's youngest and smallest charge. Sometimes, in a legitimate effort to thwart his attempts at suicide and self-harm. But sometimes, it seems, only to punish him. And that's the nub of this lawsuit." sort of gets you into the situation pretty quickly. Let me give you another example. This is from a more complicated case, an antitrust case between Microsoft and Novell. And again, these cases normally begin, the opinions normally begin with sort of a dry description of the procedural history and the legal issue at stake. Here's how Gorsuch begins this antitrust opinion. A straggler of a case, this one drags us back 20 years, to a time before the dot-com boom busted and boomed again, a time when Microsoft was busy amassing a virtual empire, if sometimes in violation of the antitrust laws. Long since found liable for a rich diversity of antitrust misdeeds in the 1990s, this case calls on us to decide whether Microsoft back then committed still another, as yet undetected, antitrust violation, this time at Novell's expense. With respect to Novell, at least, Microsoft did nothing unlawful. And finally, just an excerpt from a dissent in a case, and the facts might be hard to believe, but in Albuquerque, apparently, you had a middle school student making fake burps in the phys ed class. That might be easy.
Burps?
Burps, yes. And that might be easy to believe. What's hard to believe is that he was arrested. And the 10th Circuit eventually heard the case as to whether it was appropriate under state law to have him arrested. This is Gorsuch in dissent. Often enough, the law can be an ass, an idiot. And here, of course, he's quoting Dickens and Oliver Twist. And there is little we judges can do about it, for it is or should be emphatically our job to apply, not rewrite, the law enacted by the people's representatives. Indeed, a judge who likes every result he reaches is very likely a bad judge, reaching for results he prefers rather than those the law compels. So I admire my colleagues today, for no doubt they reach a result they dislike, but believe the law demands. And in that I see the best of our profession and much to admire. It's only that in this particular case, I don't believe the law happens to be quite as much of an ass as they do. I respectfully dissent. So, there you
have... What was the decision? Do we know?
Well, yes, the decision was that the majority said that the arrest of the burping imitator was proper.
Was justified?
Was justified. And Gorsuch came back and said, yeah, I get the feeling that you guys think you're very principled, but in fact, no. So what you have from Gorsuch is someone who understands the importance of rules orientation as opposed to results orientation. And that's what his cautionary language is about, not always liking the result. And that might give you concern if you're thinking about Roe v. Wade and how he might vote on Roe v. Wade. On the other hand, you have someone who understands the human implications of the decisions they make. And you certainly see that in that first decision where the opening paragraph tells you how he's going to decide when he's describing the restraints that are used on the young child in the detention center. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot to admire in Gorsuch.
Yeah, kind of really an amazing writer, too.
Yeah, it's very vivid writing. And you know something? Vivid writing and clear writing often means clear thinking. And I think that can only be a good thing.
Good. Interesting. All right, now for the museum update. I'm in charge of that.
That's right.
Okay. Number one, front page of the Times today, financial woes of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
Which is hard to believe. Basically.
Which is hard to believe because, you know, I go there frequently. I meet students there, and it's always jam-packed. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no such thing as going at a quiet time. And we talked before about how it would be great to sign up for that exercise class because they're getting into the museum an hour before everyone else is there.
It's more popular than it's been in a long time.
I mean, it seems to be. Admissions numbers are way up. Apparently, admissions fees are down.
Really?
Now, I don't know. Maybe it's my fault. Because, remember, the Met is pay what you will.
Right.
And that's a deal that has to do with it being on city land.
Right.
Central Park land.
Right.
So that goes way back. And I always encourage people, pay a dollar, pay 50 cents. Mm-hmm. You're going to spend, $4 or $5 for a cup of coffee in the cafeteria anyway. So they'll get your money. I believe in supporting the Met. I'm a member, et cetera. But they're having some financial woes. And the question is Thomas Campbell, the CEO, responsible? People say, well, he went straight from being a tapestry curator to having to... Well, yeah. I mean, that doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, this is a...
Well, huge, tapestries.
Well, tapestries are wonderful. Right. You know, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But how do you know how to run an organization, an institution of this size?
That's crazy.
It's pretty complex.
Yeah.
So there's that. And they have put into place a, financial officer, chief operating officer, Daniel Weiss, who probably has more of a clue.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hopeful that those things will, a lot of these issues will be able to work out. But they've had layoffs.
That's
They've
crazy.
Had
really?
Buyouts. Oh, yeah, yeah. So, and other museums have had great difficulties.
Yeah, but the Brooklyn Museum. The Met's at the top. I mean, who shouldn't be better positioned than the Met? You know who's better positioned than the Met? I know who's better positioned than the Met. It's your next subject, but go ahead.
Oh, the Vatican.
The Vatican.
Well, the Vatican is in the news. The Vatican Museum is in the news because they just appointed Barbara, I don't know how to say her last name, actually, Giada.
Strangely, I don't know.
Okay. As the new director of the Met, the Vatican museums. So that puts her at the top, one of the first women to be at the top of a major museum in the world, world-class museum like that. Also, that makes her also the highest-ranking female in the Vatican.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess that figures when you think about it. There are some limitations on what the position she might have.
And so, again, she is not someone who's had a lot of business experience. So it'll be, you know, it's a demanding undertaking. The museum does annual revenues are up to like over $300 million.
Oh. Well, we've been to the Vatican, and the scene there is a huge line to get in.
I've heard it's better.
Really?
Well, because now I think they have a reservation system.
I see. But even
before
so.
It was just you get online and you wait.
Right.
Unless, remember when we went? We had a special guide.
That's a great special guide. We have to tell this story.
We have a special
guide. We spent this guide, I don't know how many lira. 4 zillion lira.
No. It was euros, actually.
Euros. Okay, yeah. Euros. But here's just explain the service she provided us after we paid her the money.
So we were supposed to meet her at a certain place.
Yeah.
And this was all arranged through a third party. And we're standing at the meeting place. She doesn't show. She eventually shows. And then the whole idea is she's going to get us in without standing on this huge line and give us a very good and in-depth tour of the Vatican collection, which include, I mean, what you really want to see, what everybody really wants to see is the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah, I couldn't wait.
And the rooms of Raphael, yes. Et cetera. Okay, Dan. And so finally we see this woman. She's just got this tremendous red hair. Mm-hmm. And she's our guide. We hook up with her and we say, where have you been? She said, I've been here. No, I don't think so. But so how does she get us in? She says, don't say a word. Just follow me. And she cuts the line.
She cuts the line. That's right.
All the tour groups around us are kind of infuriated.
Right.
She says, don't look, just follow.
That's right.
And I can't do her strong Italian
accent.
Right.
So we basically paid her $250 and she cut the line for us. She's a cutting line expert and she's making a huge deal.
Well, she gave us a good tour. I had to help her out a little bit, but
it's an interesting color of red. Red is a compliment.
Hair, yeah.
You're being nice.
So that was fun. Anyway, so that's exciting that the Vatican... the one thing that's interesting about her, she looks like she's very into conservation and restoration, mm-hmm. and I'm excited by that.
Well, they have a big conservation operation there, if I do recall.
Yeah, because those collections go way back. The early popes thought it was very important to... They were very fascinated by ancient art, mm-hmm. and it was a matter of status and wealth and being able to present yourself as a cultured individual.
Mm-hmm.
And there are tremendous objects, tremendous number of objects from all over that need to be maintained. And plus, because of all the visitors,
mm-hmm.
the different rooms, the Sistine Chapel, et cetera, suffer a fair amount of damage.
Yeah.
Apparently the amount of dust just from people walking through is huge and presents a risk. And then down in our own country, in the capital, at the Freer in Washington, D.C., which you know is the Asian sort of arm of the National Museums, has an exhibition called The Art of the Quran. And that's just kind of interesting because the Quran is, the calligraphy is so incredible. And you have these hand illuminated manuscripts. And you may realize that in Islamic art, Islamic religious art, figurative art is prohibited. That you don't see people or animals.
Right.
And I've heard a couple of different stories about that. One is that only God can make man, you know, so man, only God can make those things, so man shouldn't presume to try to make them, even even fake.
Okay.
But also there's the idea that is shared with the Hebrew religion and the Christian religion to some extent, that the fear of idolatry. You don't want people worshiping the art as opposed to what the art is supposed to convey.
But your point
convey.
Is that's why they invest so much in the calligraphy.
Yeah. Muhammad, the prophet, said it is incumbent, beauty of handwriting is incumbent upon you. Meaning that you know, you owe it to what these words say to make them as beautiful as possible.
Okay,
And they are indeed beautiful, and they you know, they take a place of a lot of other types of decoration. So it, you know, that's only in Washington, and that's only at the Freer till February 20th. So sorry about that, but it'll be fun to see.
Switching from the museum beat.
Oh, now we get the sports beat update.
Everyone's waiting on that. Well.
It's Super Bowl Sunday.
It's Super Bowl Sunday, but let's be cool about that. Let's take a broader view of things. And there's an article in the Wall Street Journal this week about the basketball team that never takes a bad shot, and that's a high school team in Pine City, Minnesota, and where the coach looks at his team, and there's no, you know, terribly tall kids. They're all close to 6 feet tall, which is...
Basketball?
You can reach things in the supermarket, but you're not going to impress anybody in the basketball court. And he says, you know what we're going to do? We're going to just take three-point shots. Three-point shots and layups, which are very high percentage, but no mid-range shots. So much so that in their last game, they took 64 shots, attempted 64 shots.
All three-pointers?
62 of the 64 were three-pointers or layups. No, only two mid-range. So he takes that seriously. And of course, you know, things being the way they are, there's this whole discussion in the article about the statistical advantages of concentrating on a three-point shot, how the return of a three-point shot, even if the field goal percentage is not ideal, is a greater return than a two-point shot, given the way these kids take two-point shots, etc., and how certain teams in the NBA are leaning more heavily on a three-point shot, namely the Golden State team as well as Houston, which is all to the good. But when I look at an article like this, I say, you know, that's a great thing they got going in Pine City, Minnesota, because a lot of kids can play. Whereas it used to be before, you had to be 6'3 or 6'4 or at the very edge of...
So get in and take the closer shots has to be a big person.
Exactly. But the far away
shots... anybody can take the far away shots.
Well, not anybody. You got to try to be a good shooter, but you certainly have the opportunity to be that kind of shooter, even if you're only 5'10". And you'd like to think that this has dawned on this fellow in Minnesota. I think it probably has, even though it's not the focus of the article. But he certainly has the opportunity to say, because we're going to take all 20-footers, 30-footers. Anybody could hit those shots. I don't care how tall you are. You're in the game. And he could play a lot of guys. Now, why is that significant? Because one of the things that is the most important thing in my mind in terms of coaching any sport, certainly high school basketball, is trying to... make it an experience that your entire team participates in and get as many people involved in the game.
Right, to make it an inclusive experience.
Make it an inclusive experience and give everybody a positive experience. And, you know, when I was thinking about that, it seems sort of an obvious concept, but it's kind of observed in the breach. If you look at high school sports, and a lot of you probably have kids in high school sports or will, I was thinking,
me?
I did not. Not you. Not you.
In high school.
Sports. Wasn't looking to you.
Oh, you're talking to the listeners.
I was talking to the large audience, the nationwide audience, to whom we're broadcasting. And I remembered and I found there's an article which was written in Sports Illustrated about 8 or 9 years ago, 7 years ago. It was called The Audacity of Hoops, and it was about Barack Obama. And in particular, Barack Obama's high school basketball experience. He played high school basketball
in Hawaii.
In Hawaii, that's right. For a team that was the state champion. But what's interesting about this is that Barack Obama was a good but not a great player and couldn't really get playing time, at least the kind of playing time that he thought he was entitled to. And this tells you a lot about Barack Obama. So what happened? He organized a delegation to go to the coach and make the case for several of them getting more playing time. I mean, it's the politician from the word go,
even as
a sophomore, junior in high school. And the coach said, and this is the way things were, and it still is in many places, he said no. He said, the other kids, they're better than you are, and I'm not here to spread out the time evenly. I'm here to win games. I'll get you when I can. And he stuck with the other kids, and the other kids won the state championship. And it's interesting how people reflect on that now. Obama never really got over that entirely. He went back and visited the school in 2004, and he's a senator at that time. He's in a packed chapel there in this Hawaiian high school, and he literally says, according to the article, he looks out in the audience and he says, "Coach Mack," that's the coach's name, "is that you? I got to tell you something, I really wasn't as good as I thought I was." Well, that's a nice thing for him to say, but what it really tells you is it's 20 years later, and it's still high on his mind, which is that he did not get the playing time he thought. And they interview the coach and said, "You know something? I probably made a mistake. I was a young coach then, and I just wanted to win games. I wanted to do what I can. I think if I had it today and more experience, I would have done it differently. But," and here's his quote, this is the coach, "as much as I berate myself for my own lack of maturity as a coach at that time, obviously some stuff stuck with him, that's Obama, and helped shape his character. I didn't screw him up, is what I mean, and I guess he didn't." So there's a happy ending to that story, but it does take us to the story that ties us to the Super Bowl, which is a pretty nice story about Matt Ryan, who went to a school that Townsend knows very well, which is Penn Charter.
Not very well, but I've been to the school to watch water polo games.
Right.
And kids were in.
And it's a Quaker school. It's in Pennsylvania.
Well, it's a sort of, I don't know if it's considered in Philadelphia. It's on the north side of Philadelphia.
Right. The Times describes in their select private school with an enrollment of 950 from pre-kindergarten through 12th. So I haven't done the math on that, but it's not the biggest school in the world. And the fact of the matter is that, notwithstanding that it's not the biggest school in the world, that's where Matt Ryan went to school. And the Times reporter goes out there and expects to see a big trophy case containing his retired jersey or some tribute to Matt Ryan. And the quote from the coach there, he says, "We don't do that at Penn Charter." And they ask the head of the school, he says, "The notion of a shrine to someone is just not who we are." And the rest of the article talking about the possible influence of the school on Matt Ryan, it talks about one of the principal features of the school is that they have every week a session in which a number of kids are brought into a large chapel, and they spend 40 minutes in contemplation, total silence, generally
speaking. That's a normal part of Quaker observance.
Oh, news to me, but I can readily believe it. And it's something that, may arguably have benefited Matt Ryan. Certainly didn't hurt him. I mean, you're going to watch, if those of you who watch the Super Bowl this evening, you might be asking yourself whether a number of these players have spent 40 seconds in quiet contemplation. The idea of spending 40 minutes in quiet contemplation every week might only have helped them. And what's interesting is that they interview some of the kids, including Matt Ryan's friends, about that particular feature about the school. And one of them, a very good friend of Ryan, says that from time to time we've talked about those Quaker meetings. It's amazing. You miss it and you value it. It stays with you. And, you know, there may be a time in the football game today when there are players running all around doing crazy stuff and maybe Matt Ryan will be able to take a deep breath and deal with it and beat the Patriots after all.
Well, that's interesting that the school doesn't focus on individual excellence.
No, it's a Quaker perspective, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And also, you know, it doesn't hurt them, obviously. It's in, you know, you always talk about you want to spread out the playing time, for example, give everybody an opportunity, make an educational experience. Well, you know, something, maybe that helps the star player also. Takes the pressure off him and gives him a broader perspective.
So anyway, so, you know, part of me is rooting for the Falcons.
Sure.
Because, of, you know, he's kind of, he's a local guy. I like to see him do well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, moving right along here, just a couple little other items that caught my eye. One was in the travel section, and some pictures from Syria before all the destruction of this current war. And a description by someone who had traveled there about, I guess, a little more than 10 years ago. And just an interesting looking back at what Syria was like, what the people were like, and what he was like at that time, and how travel connects you with other places and people, but connects you with other sort of versions of yourself, earlier versions of yourself as well. Art and travel are always a conversation. And also in the Wall Street Journal, you know, it always has a bunch of interesting reviews of books that are coming out. It's kind of a fun review of a book on Norse mythology, which I am very weak on.
Yeah, so am I.
And it's kind of funny because I find that many of my students know tremendous amounts.
Really?
That's
what I find weird.
So I need to catch up on that. Okay, but
all right,
so finally.
There's something, there's something in the Times that just kind of struck me. It's not worth talking about at any length, but the Times has a section called the Style Section on Thursday, which is mostly about odd hats you might wear in social gatherings. I can't really figure it out. That and $800 shoes. And yet in the middle of all that, they have an article called Mr. Fix-Its of Their Own Lives. And they have three or four young men who they interview say, things weren't going anywhere. I was just kind of drinking too much and watching Netflix. And one of my friends came up to me and said, you're wasting your life. And I turned it around.
Really? So, like, what? How old are these guys?
It's a range, but one of them is as young as, let's say, 24, 25, and he says a friend took him aside and had an intervention because he's watching too much Netflix.
24, 25.
I'd like to see that conversation. I don't know if your 24-year-olds had conversations like that, but apparently they do. And then there's an article, it's a quick interview on Sunday's paper with Michael Bloomberg in terms of what he would do differently or not. No surprise, he wouldn't do anything differently. But he reflects on his career. He says,
he seems to be doing well enough.
Yeah, he says one interesting quote, a couple of things. He says, first of all, that he had an engineering degree, and yet he came back to the New School when he was in New York and took arts education, and something will warm your heart.
He didn't take arts education.
He took art appreciation.
He took art appreciation.
Ah, that's arts education.
That's pretty different.
Number two is that he said, look, an MBA is nice, but at the end, it's people skills that matter. It's how you deal with people, which I think is fair. And number three is when he talks about who he hires, he says, look, what disturbs me is you talk to kids applying today and they invariably say, I cured cancer, I brought peace to the Middle East, spare me. How about my father never existed, my mother is a convicted drug dealer, I work three shifts at McDonald's. That's the kind of kid I want. So he's looking for a hardworking guy. As he put it, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, but nobody's going to outwork me. I would go to the final thing we'll close on because it's the Super Bowl game tonight. And it's an article in the Times, which is a good one, called In Defense of the Blowout. And what the
What does that mean? Because you always tell me you're worried that something will be a blowout.
No, I'm not. I don't worry about things like that. But the fact of the matter is that
if I turn on a football game and it's a blowout, you say, oh, that, you know. Forget that.
Yeah. Okay. So
it's not an interesting game.
Well, it isn't an interesting game.
When is a blowout a good game?
Okay. His point is this. His point is that most people would say they want an exciting close game, and in the short term, that's fine. That does make it more interesting. But having said that, not for the Super Bowl. And the reason is that in the Super Bowl, while the exciting games offer short-term temporary satisfaction, this is a quote, the Super Bowl determines our champions – shapes our legends, sets our benchmarks for greatness. Life is confusing and uncertain. The blowout gives us something definitive. The blowout gives us an answer. And something to that. If you have a blowout in the Super Bowl, okay, it's not going to be exciting at 9:45 this evening. But having said that, it gives you a chance to argue for years that is this is one of the great teams. The Patriots, for example, winning 5 Super Bowls puts them in the class of the Pittsburgh Steelers of years ago or the San Francisco 49ers. It generates controversy, but it also creates a sense that's almost mythological of greatness, of great teams. And that's what you want if you're the NFL. You want the teams to be viewed as iconic. Tamsin mentioned to me something about Greek sports earlier, which I think applies.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Greeks, they like to say the Greeks made men of their gods and gods of their men. And so you see this as sort of an opportunity to make gods of men, or...
No, I don't see it as an opportunity of anything. I think as a matter of practical matter, that's what happens. I think that...
So there's still that striving, 3,000 years later.
Yeah.
There's still that sort of inherent desire for...
Well, look, here's the way I see it. I think that is the process that we're in. That's what the Super Bowl is. We're in myth-making. We're making gods of men. And then ultimately, to keep it interesting, we're making men of gods. We're tearing them down at the same time for the next generation. And that's what the Super Bowl is all about. So enjoy the game, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.